Hi, I'm Henry Ryan, and with me is Dr. Roy Clauser. And now we're going to launch into the Greeks. So, is it true, did the Greeks invent philosophy?
As far as we know, yes. In fact, as far as we know, they invented theory making as a way of explaining something. The man who's credited with that is a man named Thales of Miletus. And Thales is the first that we know of to try to give an explanation of things in terms of the properties the things have, the forces that we know impinge on it and so on, rather than making a myth about love and hate and strife and cosmic forces all personified, that kind of thing. In fact, he was quite a celebrity in his time. He traveled to Egypt, and when the people there told him how important it was that the Nile overflow its banks, and that's how they irrigated their fields, and they complained that they never knew when that was going to happen. So he took a look at things and said, well, I can tell you why. When the wind shifts around to the north and it comes against the delta, the Nile Delta, it slows the river up and the water backs up and overflows. Well, they thought he was just the greatest genius that ever lived. They gave him awards and dinners and all kinds of things. So he had quite a reputation. Aristotle tells a funny story about him, too. He says, Thales got tired of people saying, if you're so smart, how come you're not wealthy? So he had been keeping records of weather patterns. And according to that, the next year, there should be a bumper crop of olives. So he borrowed all the money he could and bought up all the olive presses. And sure enough, the next year, there was a bumper crop, and he made $1 million. And Aristotle adds the comment, this is from a guy who inherited as well, Aristotle.
Yeah.
This just shows that philosophers could all be rich if they wanted to be, but they're not interested in that sort of thing. They're just interested in philosophy. Yeah, that's easy for him to say.
Well, now, I know that philosophy is important to study. Yeah, so sure. If you're studying enterprise here to be able to do well so you can support your own ministry, I understand that there's some report out of the University of Michigan talking about how people who study philosophy majors end up actually becoming blessed materially. Is that true?
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's a sidetrack here, but I want to go there real quick.
That happened a number of years back, but one of my colleagues at the college where I taught told me about a report he had read from the University of Michigan Business School, and they did a survey among all their alumni who had made it to vice president or above in their careers.
Okay.
And it turned out that 51% were philosophy majors. That's astounding. Because usually in any university, about 5% of the graduates are philosophy majors.
5%.
But when you're trained to examine theories, and you're trained to examine them minutely,
right?
But that's logic. You're looking at the arguments, and then you're looking at the big picture. That's the other thing that philosophy always does. It looks at the overview.
Right.
That's great training for business, as it is for law, as it is for the military, as it is for so many things.
Well, and I took philosophy, then went into ministry, and I credit my philosophy training as allowing me to, study scriptures better, but also run church. Church is a little business, now house church is not, but the point is, it does take those thinkings. Now, the Greeks, did they do minutiae and did they do the whole?
Yes, they have theories that are aimed at explaining the whole character of reality.
Okay.
Or knowledge.
Okay.
Reality came first. The theories of reality came first. And there are the famous elements that the Greeks proposed. Thales himself, who invented theories, proposed the theory that the most basic thing in the universe was water.
Water.
Now, that doesn't sound convincing,
Bertrand
Russell once made the comment that if you start with that in philosophy class, you lose the respect of the class for the rest of the semester. They'll never recover. But it's not so bad as you think. He's trying to find out what it is that everything's made of.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, we know that water can evaporate. He stood there and watched it evaporate from the sea, and his theory was that the clouds are the evaporated water.
Okay. Not bad.
He watched the water come down the rivers and deposit earth, silt,
Right.
And so he thought maybe just as the water could be evaporated and make clouds, maybe it clumped up and made the earth.
Oh.
Because you know when water gets cold, it does become solid.
Right. So he just noticed these things.
Yes. So he's saying maybe this is the stuff that everything is made of because it's the most versatile.
Right.
And so the theory's wrong, but it's brilliant.
Yeah. So why do you think the Greeks were so interested in philosophy, theory making? Was it a combination of certain things occurred at that time that really created that? Or what happened there?
Okay. I think the invention of theories on the one hand.
Okay.
The development of mathematics by the Pythagoreans.
Okay. Were the Pythagoreans first? The numbers?
They are usually dated around 550 BC.
Okay, and so that's earlier.
Thales is usually a little earlier.
Oh, so Thales comes first.
Yeah.
Then comes the mathematics.
The theories and then the math.
And then comes Plato and...
That's later, huh?
Okay, yep. There's Socrates.
400s, in the 300s, Aristotle. I think Aristotle died in 330-something.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's a succession there. They're taught by one another. You know?
Okay.
Plato says that he learned from his uncle Socrates. And then Aristotle went to Plato's academy for 20 years.
Okay.
So he's a student of Plato.
Mm-hmm.
These things are passed down.
So how has Greek philosophy influenced Bible times, influenced philosophy, influenced the world? I mean, so as we study Greek, what are some of the things that we credit to Greek philosophy that is still in philosophy or maybe even in Christianity today?
Well, there's good and bad.
Okay.
My opinion.
No, that's good.
For one thing, they developed logic.
Okay.
We mentioned this.
That's
Aristotle.
Good. Right.
Comes up with a syllogism, a way to check on whether premises really yield the conclusions they're supposed to yield. And that's logical entailment. You get theory making brought to quite a height in Plato and in Aristotle.
Okay.
And the danger, though, is that, as I see it, that those people were pagan thinkers.
Right.
So we don't expect them to have insight into the transcendent creator who reveals himself in the Bible and comes incarnate in Christ. But what these people did instead was to take some facet, some aspect of the world around us and make that the divine part of reality, the self-existent part that generates all the rest.
Right.
Yeah.
And how did Plato do that?
Well, for Plato, it was the forms.
Okay.
It's what he called forms. It's perfections. For Plato, there's another realm of reality besides the one that we live in and see every day. And in this other realm are perfect circles, perfect squares, lines that are exact.
Oh, okay.
Okay, all the things that are imperfect in this world, but we treat as though they're perfect.
Right.
That's because there are these perfections
that
the things in this world imperfectly copy.
Okay.
But then he went further. Why not make that the explanation of everything? So in this other realm, there's the perfect horse and the perfect tree and the perfect color blue. And all the things that are horses or trees or blue are copies of the perfections in the other world. Aristotle thought that theory was wacko. and he modified greatly, but he still keeps the idea of perfections impacting matter so as to form things. So there's still such a thing as what it is to be a horse that combines with matter to make horses.
Okay.
And that's the way
Now, in Christianity, if you just take that philosophy, and we call it syncretism, where you just take this, and then you superimpose it on Christian thinking in the Bible, what's happened is throughout the history of the world, there's been Platonic Christianity, Neoplatonism, Christianity, and view. So later on in the history of the church and Christianity, some of this connects.
Yes. In my view, that's to be regretted, but it did happen. In other words, these pagan thinkers are taking parts of some aspect of the universe and making that the divine part that generates all the rest. All right, when Christians come and they look at that, they say to themselves, well, no part of the universe is self-existent, divine, and generates all the rest. That's God. And that part they got right. I'm grateful for that. But then they thought about it and they said, but there's no reason to reject this method of explaining the world around us, okay, because maybe, although what it is in the world that generates everything else in the world isn't divine because it depends on God, maybe there still is something that does that. There's some aspects of the world that generate all the rest, and right, then they in turn depend on God. If we keep that scheme of things, then we could go right on trying to see whether it's Plato that matches up best with our Christianity, or it's Aristotle, or it's the right, Neoplatonists, or it's the Nominalists, or it's Cartesian dualism, or it's Kant, or it's Hegel, or it's existentialism. We get this long parade of right, things hooked up with Christianity, trying to make sense of the world around us. And I think that was a fateful and awful right, decision to make, because Colossians 1 tells us that God has created everything visible or invisible.
Right.
And that means God's created the laws that govern the world too. It's not the case that mathematics and logic are in some other divine realm. They're in this realm and they're creatures. They're created by God. And we don't have to take anything in the universe to be that in which all the rest depends on. And for the very reason that Colossians 1 gives us. Colossians 1 says that God has created and sustains in existence all things through Jesus Christ. And it doesn't say that in a way that leaves it open, well, it may be Jesus plus matter, or Jesus plus the mathematical laws and the logical laws. It's just Jesus Christ. And everything about creation is creaturely, and everything depends on Christ. In Christ, all things hang together, says verse 17. And that's what this strategy for theorizing has missed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you reject it, then you start with God as the creator, the Christ as the only mediator of God's power of creation and sustaining to the world. And then you have a very different program for explaining. You don't take anything within the world as what generates all the rest. Instead, you look at how things, you look empirically at how things are in fact related. You trace out causal pathways as they exist without a pre-commitment to reduce everything to just to this one or that one.
Gotcha.
So overestimate this and underestimate the rest. And it's a distinctive program for an ontology and an epistemology.
So one last question about the Greeks. Why is studying the Greeks so important?
There's an old saying that philosophers are more often remembered for the questions they raised than for the answers they gave to them.
Okay.
The answers seem to come and go. People reject the answers, but the questions stick in people's minds. And they still, sometimes the questions aren't properly posed. That's part of the problem. But the questions tend to endure. So, for example, Immanuel Kant, this philosopher who died in 1801, Kant raised the question, how much of our experience is our own contribution? What are we contributing to our own experience? And a Christian philosopher like Dewey is going to say, we bring to the table our religious commitment, what we regard as divine, even if it's an unconscious commitment.
Right, right.
What do we think is the self-existent reality that generates everything else? It's either God or a God substitute. It's
right.
God or it's an idol.
Right.
And that guides, it pushes the way we think. It delimits theories that are going to look acceptable
right,
or not.
Right.
And so he answers that in one way. Kant thought it was way more than that. We read in space and time and logic
right,
and
right,
numbers. And he made the human mind the lawgiver to creation instead of God.
Right, right.
Then a Christian's going to come at that very different way, answer that question differently. It's not an improper question, though.
Right. So how would Dewey analyze the Greek question? How would he say that what did the Greeks bring out of their own presuppositions?
Okay, he thinks that overall, you take stand back and see what's going on in all the theories, they have a commitment to that there is some kind of stuff And they call it matter.
Okay.
But it means material.
Yeah.
And then there's some source of order to the stuff. And he takes, and the Greeks took each of those to be self-existent. They just are.
Ah, okay.
All right? And then the cosmos in which we live is the result of the combination of the principles of order, whether that's mathematics or Plato's forms or Aristotle's secondary substances, how they impress the matter and make material things into definite entities, like trees and horses and people, mountains, clouds. And okay. And Plato called the principles of order form. So Doyerud says it's this seeing reality as form and matter.
Right.
And those two things have the place of divinity in their thought.
Okay.
Of course, they also believed in gods and goddesses. They thought that divine power wasn't exhausted in form and matter. There's leftover divine power.
Right.
And it collects in these beings.
Okay.
So, but crucial to the Greek outlook was the gods weren't crucial for that.
Right,
that was
a
popular religion.
Right.
So when you have Protagoras writing, he writes the classic on the gods. It's an essay.
Yeah.
And I still remember translating this. The first sentence reads, concerning the gods, it is not possible to say whether they are or are not.
Right. But in their mind, it is possible to say form and matter.
Oh, absolutely. That's
that's
the way they see reality.
Okay.
A source of order and some kind of stuff that gets ordered, and both of them are independent reality.
So as you read through the Greeks, notice the form and matter.
Yeah.
Notice maybe you can see some of those presuppositions, some of their faith commitments. And as you get foundational Greek philosophy thinking, you'll notice this form, matter, they call it a dualism.
Yes,
that,
it's a dualism.
That goes through much of philosophy. Sure. So even if you go to Kant later on, you mention his name way in the 19th century, he dies for 1801.
Yes.
But you'll notice that some of these questions and themes happen then. So to study the Greeks is an important first piece as you explore the world of philosophy.
There's an interesting way in which form and matter impacts even the practice of medicine.
Right.
When the Greeks undertook to treat someone, they would do it only if the person could be restored to normalcy.
Oh.
See, nearest thing to the perfect
form. The perfect design.
If there's no possibility of that, they wouldn't treat them. The Jewish and Christian way of treating patients is to relieve pain.
Right.
But the Greeks have an ideal to meet. If you can't meet the ideal, you don't bother with the patient.
Good. There you go. Engage in your study of the Greeks.